this is over if he does not get back to the White House. And he can do that even if he loses by 10 million votes, as I expect, in the fall, because we elect through the Electoral College. Donald Trump doesn't get back to the White House, then what lies ahead for him is financial ruin, bankruptcy, and prison. A long, multiple long prison sentences from both state and federal criminal courts, because Donald Trump has committed serious criminal acts his whole life. And finally, after a half century of lying, cheating, stealing, plying 12-year-olds with liquor so they would gamble, doing extraordinary favors for one of the biggest cocaine traffickers in America, he's finally being held to account.
Finally, David K. Johnston, why isn't it raised that Laura Trump, who's now helping to head the RNC, is married to Eric Trump? She benefits from money going directly to the Trumps because he also has to pay up millions of dollars.
You know, 9 years ago, Amy, on your program, I said Donald Trump is a wannabe dictator. And when you're a dictator, you surround yourself with the people you trust, and the people you trust most are family. So he has now installed his daughter-in-law at the Republican National Committee, which is close to broke in terms of how much money parties should have, and has no money for down-ballot candidates, which is bad for the party.
David K. Johnston, Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative journalist. That does it for our show. Happy birthday, Nermeen Sheikh.
You're tuned into listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
When the farmer comes to town with his wagon broken down, the farmer is...
Tune into the Dirtbag every second Wednesday of the month at 11 a.m.
Learn to grow your tasty fruits and vegetables in your home garden.
There is a monthly garden stumper, calendar of gardening events. You can even call in with your gardening questions.
That's the Dirtbag every second Wednesday, 11 to 12 a.m. That's on
KBOO
Portland.
Listen,
laugh,
learn.
The farmer is the man that feeds them all.
KBOO just finished our annual All Thrills, No Frills special programming campaign. We want to thank all of our supporters for helping us bring the community engaging, unique, and all-around fun special episodes and killer marathons. We wouldn't be able to do it without our listeners. And if you missed out on any of the programming, you can check out the list of specials at kboo.fm/thrills.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, six people are still missing in the collapse of Key Bridge in Baltimore after the span was hit by a cargo ship. Northeast Portland's Pacific Market is destroyed in a fire. And Salem-Keizer unionized teachers reach a tentative agreement with the district, likely averting a possible strike. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, March 26th, 2024. I'm Althea Billings. Around 1:30 a.m. this morning, a cargo ship collided with a bridge in Baltimore, collapsing a span of the bridge. Six people are still missing as of time of recording. The Francis Scott Key Bridge holds the southern stretch of Interstate 695, and it's an important route for cars and trucks. The ship is called the Dali, a Singaporean-flagged vessel that was contracting with the Danish shipping company Maersk. Minutes before crashing into the bridge support, the cargo ship appears to go dark, losing power and propulsion based on video footage. The crew called Mayday as this happened, which allowed officials to stop traffic at either end of the bridge and evacuate people from the span before it was damaged. But the six people still missing were part of a construction crew that were filling potholes on the bridge. They didn't evacuate. Two construction workers have been rescued from the water by search and rescue crews. Divers have had limited ability to search the area because of the twisted wreckage of the bridge under the water. It's a tragedy that raises questions about what infrastructure elements could help prevent a bridge from being hit by a ship like that. The bridge collapse has been compared to the 1980 collapse of the Sunshine Skyway Bridge in Tampa, Florida, also a result of ship collision. When the bridge was rebuilt, it included 36 structures called dolphins. In this case, those are concrete structures around the foundations that help prevent a ship from hitting them. The Key Bridge in Baltimore had 4 dolphins, but their relatively far placement from the pylons of the bridge allowed the ship to come in at an angle and hit the supports. It's also worth noting that the Baltimore Harbor is known to be a tricky one to navigate. The loss of the bridge means people can't get across, but it also means ships can't get in or out of Baltimore Harbor, which is likely to create some supply chain problems. The Port of Baltimore plays an important role in the shipment of vehicles. It ranks first in the nation for the amount of cars, trucks, and farming machinery that come through the port. President Biden and Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg spoke on the issue today and committed federal help to repair the bridge and the port. The National Highway and Transportation Safety Administration is investigating the incident. A large fire has destroyed Pacific Market in Portland near Northeast Broadway and Northeast 67th. Portland Fire and Rescue responded just before 2 a.m. The strip mall that caught on fire contained Pacific Market, an Asian market, and a closed Vietnamese restaurant called Thai Bin. Crews reported smoke coming from the roof over the vacant restaurant space, and 20 minutes later, heavy smoke started pushing out of the door, and firefighters worried the wall would collapse. 8 nearby homes were evacuated for safety. Fire and Rescue says 20-foot-tall flames coming from the top of the building were close to the homes, but they were able to keep it from spreading and residents returned unharmed. The fire was brought under control around 4 a.m. There are no reported injuries, and the cause of the fire is being investigated. Pacific Market has been operating on Broadway for decades. They're known for selling produce like breadfruit and durian, plus Vietnamese condiments and pantry staples. It's unclear when or if the market will reopen. There's a good chance the food sold in your local supermarket was grown in a field where pesticides were sprayed. The fight over the use of these chemicals within agriculture saw new developments this year, leading to renewed calls for stronger enforcement against violators, as well as a tighter regulatory structure. Mike Mullen has more in South Dakota.
Pesticides are still common in agriculture. Organic producers who avoid them have seen ups and downs in pushing for stronger regulations, and they point to a South Dakota example of the harm associated with widespread use among neighboring farms. At the heart of the regulatory fight is the application of the weed-killing pesticide dicamba and how it can drift from one farm to another. Last month, a federal court blocked over-the-top spraying of dicamba products, but the EPA followed with an order to allow the spraying of existing supplies. Glenn Pulse co-owns an organic farm in Vermilion and says a 2017 drift incident had a big impact on his operation.
Our entire farm was covered. We lost a lot of livestock. Thousands of bees were killed.
It also resulted in health concerns for his family, having to regain his organic farmer certification and a legal battle over restitution. Groups such as the National Family Farm Coalition have been fighting what they call the deregulation of these chemicals, arguing the drift and runoff effect has damaged millions of crops. Dicamba manufacturing companies deny responsibility, instead blaming farmers who apply it for not following guidelines. And the EPA says there were already millions of gallons of dicamba in circulation prior to the court's ruling, prompting the agency's order. Pulse feels there are farmers who are careful in spraying chemicals, but he wants stronger enforcement against those he describes as loose cannons.
The guys that are not following the labels and are spraying in weather conditions that are not favorable, that is where I would say 90% of the problems are happening with drift incidents.
His calls for better responses to these incidents coincide with policy demands to heavily restrict dicamba products. Meanwhile, South Dakota Congressman Dusty Johnson is the main sponsor of a bill supporters say would assure uniformity in national pesticide labeling under federal law. But opponents argue it would limit longstanding state and local pesticide safety rules. This is Mike Moen for Greater Dakota News Service.
Unionized teachers in the Salem-Keizer School District have reached a tentative agreement with the district, likely averting a strike. Last week, nearly 95% of unionized teachers voted to strike over contract negotiations. Early this morning, though, teachers were alerted that a tentative agreement had been reached. It includes a nearly 10% salary increase over the two-year contract. It also includes a $6,000 one-time retention bonus for staff, plus more pay for bilingual and special education staff. Funds will be committed to help prioritize smaller elementary school classes. The deal adds an hour of prep time each week for elementary school teachers. This all comes after nearly a year of contract bargaining. Union President Tyler Skello-Lakeberg said in a statement, quote, "There is always more to do to build the schools our students deserve, but these new investments in school safety, educator workload, and scheduling, and this new start on addressing class size mark a paradigm shift in how our public schools will operate on a day-to-day basis," end quote. The next step in the process is contract ratification by the union and the district. Markham Elementary School will not reopen for the next school year. The Southwest Portland school was damaged extensively in the January ice storm, and construction crews have been working on repairs ever since. Earlier reports from the crew said they would be closed through the end of the school year, but back in the fall. Now estimates say construction will take longer than that. Portland Public School officials wrote to staff and families saying, quote, "We understand that this news is incredibly upsetting. We had hoped to be able to finish reconstruction of the Markham building this summer, but given the extent of the damage and the scope of hazardous material abatement that has to be completed before repair work can begin, that is simply not feasible," end quote. The letter also says the building could reopen in late fall, but that date is subject to change. Students and teachers have been traveling to four other schools in the district while Markham is closed. PPS says they'll be sending out an invitation for parents to come to a community meeting where they can ask questions about the closure. The UN Security Council passes a ceasefire resolution as the U.S. warns Israel against ground operations in Rafah and top Israeli officials cancel a D.C. trip. Trump's bond is slashed by two-thirds, but his first criminal trial starts in 3 weeks. With more on these stories, it's Farah Siddiqui with 2024 Talks.
Welcome to 2024 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
Today, this council spoke out to bring about an immediate and sustainable ceasefire, secure the immediate release of all hostages, and help alleviate the tremendous suffering of Palestinian civilians in Gaza.
UN Ambassador Linda Thomas-Greenfield says the U.S. would not veto a resolution for a Gaza ceasefire lasting through the rest of Ramadan, with release of hostages and urgent humanitarian aid. The rest of the Security Council voted for it. In response to letting it pass, Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu canceled a D.C. trip by two top advisors. Israeli cabinet member and Netanyahu rival Benny Gantz is already in Washington as the White House lobbies against a ground offensive in Rafah. On ABC, Vice President Kamala Harris warned it could impact U.S. relations.
We have been clear in multiple conversations and in every way that any major military operation in Rafah would be a huge mistake.
Over the weekend, Congress passed a $1.2 trillion appropriation to fund the government through the rest of the fiscal year. Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders voted against it because it stripped out funding for the UN agency providing Palestinian aid.
Tens of thousands of people are starving. UNRWA is trying to feed them. Sadly, tragically, many members of Congress seem to be happy to be part of this starvation caucus.
Critics in the U.S. and Europe have blocked UNRWA funding because a small number of its employees appear to have worked with Hamas. But another progressive, New York Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, also voted no and accused Israel of genocide.
If you want to know what an unfolding genocide looks like, open your eyes. It looks like the forced famine of 1.1 million innocents. Children eating grass as their bodies consume themselves while trucks of food are slowed and halted just miles away.
A New York court has cut by two-thirds the bond former President Donald Trump must pay to appeal his civil conviction for business fraud. The court also gave him 10 more days to post bond, which Trump says he would do.
So I greatly respect the decision of the appellate division, and I'll post either $175 million in cash or bonds or security or whatever is necessary very quickly within the 10 days, and I thank the appellate division for acting quickly.
A separate New York court says Trump's first criminal trial for making and covering up hush payments to a porn star will start in 3 weeks. I'm Farah Siddiqui for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
Hey, how are you?
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Coast Range Radio. At 6, it's This Way Out. Then at 7, Eco Justice Radio. Tonight's weather will be cloudy with a low of 42 degrees. Tomorrow's weather will be rainy with a high of 54. Today in history, in 1975, the Biological Weapons Convention comes into force. It's a disarmament treaty that effectively bans biological and toxin weapons by prohibiting their development, production, acquisition, transfer, stockpiling, and use. The BWC was the first multilateral disarmament treaty to ban the production of an entire category of weapons of mass destruction. The quote of the day is from American investigative journalist Bob Woodward, known for breaking the Watergate scandal. He was born today in 1943. He said, quote, "The central dilemma in journalism is that you don't know what you don't know." Water and sewer bill support programs funding is running out. That comes at a time when a new federal report shows that tribal households have struggled to keep their taps flowing. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A pandemic-era program that helped low-income people keep up with their water and sewer bills is running out of funding. Montana Public Radio's Aaron Bolton reports this comes as a federal report shows rural and tribal households have long struggled to keep their taps on.
Congress's Water Utility Assistance Program supported over 8,000 Montana households and ran out of money last year. A separate pool of water assistance funding for tribes is close to running dry, too. A federal report found tribal families are more likely to be in debt to their water utilities and owe more money. It also found that rural households experience higher disconnection rates for non-payment. Patricia Corshane with the Confederated Salish and Kootenai Tribes says the water assistance program was a lifeline for those families, but adds that it's also helped households on well water.
When you have bacteria or something like that in your water and you're unable to drink it, you can get a bottled water system put into your home through this program.
Corshane says the tribes have about half of the roughly $600,000 they received left. She says families could struggle to afford clean drinking water once that funding runs out. In Columbia Falls, I'm Aaron Bolton.
Federal agencies are asking for public feedback on 5 potential plans for managing Bears Ears National Monument in southeast Utah. KUER's David Kondos reports for the Mountain West News Bureau on the collaboration with tribes.
The plans are the result of a first-of-its-kind collaboration between federal agencies and 5 tribes to incorporate indigenous knowledge into the monument's management. Ruben Pacheco is with the Bears Ears Intertribal Coalition. He says this is especially historic because public lands across the West often overlap with ancestral homelands.
So ensuring that tribal perspectives are meaningfully involved in the protection of these lands is a way to respect tribes, and it's a move towards what we consider repairing historical injustices.
The plan preferred by the partnership is Option E, which would limit some cattle grazing, off-highway driving, and camping. Rachel Wooten is with the Bureau of Land Management office in Monticello. She says the best way for people to make sure their voices are heard is to study the plans before responding.
The most helpful comments are the ones that provide new information, provide specific information about a use or an area that we might not have known or considered.
The agencies will launch a series of meetings to answer questions about the plans starting in April. I'm David Kondos in St. George.
In New Mexico, during a ceremony in Albuquerque last week, former Cochiti Pueblo governor and U.S. Marine Corps and Vietnam veteran Dr. Joseph Suina was presented with service medals he earned in the 1960s. U.S. New Mexico Senator Martin Heinrich helped retrieve the medals, which were stolen in the 70s in a house break-in. Heinrich also honored the veteran last week on the Senate floor, talking about his medals, which included the Purple Heart.
Dr. Suina also earned the following awards: the Combat Action Ribbon, the Marine Corps Good Combat Medal, the National Defense Service Medal, the Armed Forces Expeditionary Medal, Vietnam Service Medal, Rifle Sharpshooter's Badge, Pistol Expert Badge, and he also earned a Gallantry Cross Medal from the Republic of Vietnam. I was deeply honored to help retrieve these medals that recognize Dr. Suina's incredible bravery and sacrifices.
He was also recognized for his advocacy, especially for raising awareness of PTSD. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
New York's legislature is considering a bill to hold fashion companies accountable for their role in climate change. The Fashion Act aims to hold clothing and footwear companies accountable for the vast impacts they have on the environment. Edwin J. Vieira has more.
A New York bill aims to regulate the fashion industry's climate change impacts. The Fashion Act would hold clothing and footwear companies accountable for their environmental impacts. Fashion accounts for up to around 9% of global greenhouse gas emissions, more than the aviation industry. The bill also creates a remediation fund for environmental, community, or labor-related projects. Rich Schrader with the Natural Resources Defense Council describes how enforcement of the bill works.
The bill will create a enforcement mechanism that the Attorney General in New York State will be responsible to. So it's given a monitoring, investigative, and enforcement set of authorities. That's to ensure the companies are in compliance.
He says the Attorney General could fine companies not in compliance with these guidelines. But fast fashion companies like Shein have only made things worse. These companies make clothes designed to be worn less than a handful of times before they're tossed away, ending up in a landfill. Fast fashion is responsible for around 10% of global carbon dioxide emissions. The bill has been referred to the Assembly's Consumer Affairs and Protection Committee. A United Nations report finds more than one quarter of signatories to the Fashion Industry Charter for Climate Action are working with lawmakers on climate-related issues and regulations. However, Maxine Baydot with the New Standards Institute says issues persist in greening the process of making clothes.
The textile mills, which are the ones that, you know, would be responsible for decarbonizing, are not getting any price premiums from the brands that they work with to decarbonize. There are zero incentives for them to decarbonize, even though the technologies are there.
She notes more collaboration is needed between brands and manufacturers to develop an incentive structure. Baydot sees this bill as the foundation to build on, which a federal bill could do. The Fabric Act establishes safer working conditions for garment workers, but also could improve industry-wide sustainability. This is Edwin J. Vieira for New York News Connection.
Excitement and curiosity are building for the Great American Solar Eclipse as scientists, researchers, and armchair space buffs wait eagerly for the April 8th event. The last eclipse was in 2017 and was best seen on the West Coast, including in southern Oregon. This one will be best viewed by a large portion of the eastern U.S., and medical experts hope observers will wear designated eclipse sunglasses to avoid eye damage. Terry D. has the details.
Excitement and curiosity are building for a scientific phenomenon that has not happened since 2017. On April 8th, a total solar eclipse will briefly put parts of the United States, Mexico, and Canada in complete darkness. The path of the Great American Solar Eclipse's reach is about 150 miles in width, and Eastern Time Zone residents could expect the eclipse to begin around 3 p.m. and last almost 6 minutes. Purdue University professor Barrett Caldwell says, for a total eclipse, the entire disk of the sun is blocked or covered by the moon.
This is one of the most impactful, amazing, visible celestial experiences that a human can have.
Viewing sites are expected to draw large crowds, which means some businesses and schools may close for the day. Law enforcement is focusing on public safety and handling traffic gridlock at statewide watch locations. The Indianapolis Motor Speedway will open its doors for thousands of attendees to experience the eclipse. Ophthalmologists are advising those who plan to observe the eclipse to protect their eyes. A 2024 report by JAMA Ophthalmology says serious eye damage, even blindness, can occur if eclipse-specific glasses are not worn. Caldwell says eye damage from a retinal burn from staring at the sun is immediate, although we do not feel the effects right away.
So if you're staring at the sun, you are actually putting lots and lots of that sun's energy onto your retina, where the rods and cones are that allow you to see. And then you can burn those rods and cones and cause damage. We don't have a way of repairing that damage medically.
Space.com reports one case in New York of a woman who viewed the 2017 eclipse for 6 seconds without the correct glasses. Doctors later diagnosed her with photochemical burns and solar retinopathy, a condition that can cause blurriness or blindness and has no cure. This is Terry D. for Indiana News Service.
One of the oldest and most important U.S.-China agreements on cooperation in science and technology is up for renewal. The agreement has been of immense benefit to both countries, but it's now in danger of falling victim to anti-China sentiment in Congress. Now we go to a Global Citizen commentary on the issue from Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. The opinions expressed in the following piece are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone. What is the longest running and most successful agreement between the United States and the People's Republic of China? It's the U.S.-China Agreement on Cooperation in Science and Technology, S&T for short, that has been around since 1979, when relations were officially normalized. By the time the agreement was renewed in 2011, scientific cooperation had expanded dramatically to include agricultural science, high-energy physics, clean energy, and biomedical research. Now the S&T might expire if the anti-China crowd in Congress wins the argument that China will not respect intellectual property rights and will use collaborative research to support its military. For the moment, the agreement remains in effect on a temporary basis. Presidents Biden and Xi Jinping extended the S&T for 6 months when they met in San Francisco last fall, and just a few weeks ago it was extended again for 6 months. Supporters of the S&T acknowledge that cooperation can be abused, but they point to the greater benefits. Those include the window provided into Chinese research and the opportunity to engage the Chinese on U.S. concerns and common interests. The agreement has helped China transition from ozone-depleting CFCs and enabled the sharing of influenza data used to devise yearly vaccines. It has also facilitated data sharing about satellites, climate and seismic activities, as well as fusion and subatomic particle experiments. As the journal Nature reports, quote, some 3 million Chinese students have studied at universities in the United States since the agreement was brokered. In 2021, U.S. universities awarded more than 8,000 doctorates to students from China out of a total of around 25,000 international doctorates. Each country is the other's biggest research partner by a considerable margin, unquote. In fact, U.S.-China scientific collaboration on published research tops all other international collaborations by a wide margin. The possibility of another Trump presidency is frightening in terms of how it would impact U.S.-China relations. Scientific cooperation would be one sure target. Recall that it was under Trump's Justice Department that the China Initiative was installed, leading thousands of Chinese scientists to return home rather than face unwarranted scrutiny over their allegiances. The Biden administration just celebrated the 2-year anniversary of termination of the China Initiative, marking the occasion with a roundtable of prominent Asian American scholars and officials at the White House. The group committed to, quote, working with the White House on changing the climate of fear to one where we celebrate the immense contributions of our Asian American scholar community, who have been the foundation of U.S. leadership in science and technology, unquote. But the negative fallout from the China Initiative is still felt in some places, such as Florida, where educational institutions are banned from hiring Chinese scientists. I should note that in Canada, a married Chinese-born couple who worked at Canada's top microbiology lab were identified as having passed secrets to China that, according to Canadian intelligence sources, posed a, quote, realistic and credible threat to Canada's economic security, unquote. Her couple was fired in 2021, but the Trudeau administration kept the incident under wraps until now, prompting opposition politicians to charge that it was reluctant to take action against Chinese national security threats. Currently, among the projects U.S. and Chinese scientists are working on is a miniature nuclear research reactor that would not require use of weapons-grade uranium as fuel. China already exports small reactors to a few developing countries. Climate change collaboration has resumed, especially between California and China, to study transitioning away from fossil fuels. A third area of research collaboration is in the re-evaluation of economic growth to reflect nature's role. The traditional emphasis on GDP fails to consider the costs of growth from environmental destruction or neglect, or, on the positive side, the strengths of an economy that come from embracing sustainable development and protection of natural resources. China seems ready to continue the SNT. An embassy spokesman in Washington said, quote, China is ready to discuss the content and form of the agreement with the United States on the basis of equality and mutual benefit, unquote. Harvard's John Holdren, who signed the initial SNT when he served as Obama's director of the Office of Science and Technology Policy, agrees. The SNT signing, he said, gave a form of permission for lab-to-lab, university-to-university, scientist-to-scientist cooperation. It legitimized the whole notion that collaboration was respectable. That spirit needs to be revitalized. It has served both countries well, and renewal is especially important now at a time of technological decoupling between the two countries. I'm Mel Gertow for The Global Citizen. Thanks for listening.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, March 26th, 2024. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Mel Gertoff, the producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Farah Siddiqui, Terry D., Antonia Gonzalez, Edwin J. Vieira, and Mike Moen. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members.